Good evening. My name's Bob Fuchs. I'm the associate pastor here at Brighton First United Methodist, and I welcome you all to the first of our three sessions in the Exploring Islam series. In just a couple minutes, Myrna Henderson, who was actually instrumental in bringing this to our attention and getting this going, she'll be introducing our presenter, John Schultz. But I wanted to just give you a quick outline for the evening from a schedule standpoint, not so much of a subject, but we're going to start off. John will be coming up. He'll be speaking for about an hour, and then we'll be taking a break. There's decaf coffee, I believe, and some other beverages and cider, because it is homemade cookies. This is getting better all the time. See, because if we don't have food, right, it's not an official event. And so we will have food. And then after that, because there's always costs associated with every seminar that we get involved with, we're going to be doing a free will offering. And any money that we raise above and beyond our cost, with all of the recent disasters, the United Methodist Committee on Relief, UMCOR, has been very active and is always in need of resources. So anything that we raise in excess of what we need to put on this seminar will be going to disaster relief through UMCOR. And so that's a quick overview. We'll finish up no later than 9, right, John? Because it's past some of our bedtimes at that point. But I'm thrilled that we're doing this opportunity, you know, coming together to hear this presentation. And I'm going to turn it over to Myrna Henderson so she can do the introduction.
Thank you, Bob. This is really an honor for me. We moved in about 3 years ago as neighbors across the street from John and Karen Schultz, and we knew right away what special people they were as neighbors. But it was only a year ago when I attended this same seminar at St. Pat's that I realized what a wealth of information and devotion this man has. And so immediately I thought, we need this for our people too. He has just a wide breadth of understanding, and he's so good at expressing his interest in the great religions of the world. As we learn what we have in common and then begin to respect each other's differences, I feel as though we are using our talents to build bridges instead of walls. As we develop a closer understanding of who we are and who they are, those walls come down and we begin to appreciate each other more. And that's my hope for tonight. John's interest in world religions inspired him to earn a master's degree in history and religions from the University of Detroit. And he taught world religions on the high school level, community college, and university level for 40 years. So this guy really knows his stuff. Since retiring, he has continued to teach in seminars such as this with adults and groups all over the area. Please welcome my good friend and yours by the end of the evening, John Schultz.
Before you start,
yes,
I'd like to pray over you and pray for everyone
that
who's here this evening. It wasn't in the script, so I apologize for doing
that. It was in mine,
that.
So you're on the same wavelength.
It came to me, and it's the Holy Spirit. Please join me in prayer. Creator God, everything comes from you. As we gather this evening, we thank you for this man who is about to share his experience, his knowledge, his understanding with us. May our minds, hearts, and our spirits be open to hearing the words, to taking them in, and allowing us to understand a little bit more about our world and it's your world. Guide us, bless this discussion. In your holy name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Bob. Well, good evening. What started off over 40 years ago as a profession quickly became a passion. And in more recent years, when there is such a need for us to know about people of other religious persuasions, not just in different denominations within Christianity, but I mean different religions entirely, that there is such a need. And every time that I hear, as you have heard, ignorant comments made about Jews or Muslims or Sikhs or whoever. You know, it just gets me in the heart. So anyway, just a couple of things. I don't expect that this is a need here, but since it happened once, whenever I do these presentations, I do mention it's a caveat. And this series of three seminars, mini seminars, is intended to be an educational exposition of Islam. So if anybody by chance, although I don't think that's true here, but it did happen once, has come with a political / religious agenda, it doesn't have any place here, okay? And I won't deal with it at all. I welcome, I don't intend this to be, most of it's going to be my sharing, but I will welcome your participation, your observations, your questions, okay? And whether it's during the body of the presentation, or we'll have a Q&A at the end too if you want to save it for then. We will have a break, as Bob mentioned, and I do ask you kindly to give me the break also, because what happens, as you know, people zero in on the whoever the speaker is, and he or she doesn't get any break. Okay, so please, I'd like to enjoy the break also. And so my role here is to give you an overview of Islam, its history this evening, historical background. 2 weeks from now, we'll do the beliefs and practices, which I think that's the real practicality of the whole series. And then the last one, Islam in more modern times. And that's where we get into some nitty-gritty stuff of today. So as Myrna used the phrase, the great religions of the world, there are so-called five great religions of the world, and their historical birthing. We have Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Islam is the only one, those are called traditionally the five great religions of the world. Islam is the only one of those, already since I put it in that order, that came to be after Jesus Christ. And so it's rather unique in that regard. It's centuries after Christianity was born, okay? So we start with Muhammad. Muhammad was born, and if we do an overview of the map here, he was born in, if we can see this, okay, this is Saudi Arabia, okay, a little fuzzy for me at this distance here, okay, Mecca and Medina. Mecca is right here, okay, so Muhammad was born into Mecca. He was born into the upper aristocracy. And it was a very polytheistic society. They worshipped many gods and goddesses. In the center of the city of Mecca, in a huge oval, which was probably about a quarter of a mile in diameter, you know, altogether, they had dozens and dozens of statues, some carved in wood, some carved in stone, some made out of metal. Bone, perhaps, you know, around the perimeter, and right in the middle of this oval was a shrine, and it was the Kaaba, K-A apostrophe B-A, the Kaaba. We're going to come back to that later on, but what Mecca was, it was the center of the whole trade route coming down from the north. Mecca was the southernmost terminus, and it was a very wealthy city. And what they did there, they would, as the caravans would come, they would be hosted by the Meccans and so on, and business was good. But once a year especially, in the spring fertility rites, every caravan imaginable poured from the north into Mecca, and they would sell, the gold and silversmiths had a heyday selling the trinkets of the various gods and goddesses, and then they would sacrifice hundreds and hundreds of lambs and dedicate this sacrifice to the main gods that were housed in this black box house called the Kaaba. And, for example, Kuba was the main god in there. He took care, he was like the supreme god over everything, and then they held all the other ones. And so the Meccans made a lot of money, especially the upper crust. And again, business was good. And this had been going on for for generations upon generations. And so Muhammad is born into this society in 570 A.D., or A.D., or C.E., if you prefer that, you know, the common era. Anyway, he ended up going to work for a lady by the name of Khadija. She was a widow, a very wealthy one, and she owned a camel caravan. So he went to work for her, and as a testimony to his prowess, he quickly rose up the ranks, and he was put in charge of the caravan. Well, he and Khadija fell in love with one another. She was a bit his senior, and they married. If you're married to the boss, you don't need to work anymore. And so Muhammad had this luxury of time, and he used to go outside the city of Mecca, up into the foothills, and he would sit not by the hour, but sometimes by the days, 2-3 days at a time, and they'd say, well, what do you do? And they simply called it, he called it his cave, and that's how it was referred, you know, his cave. What do you do in your cave? Well, he said, I just sit and I look out and I think. And his uncle told him one time, Abu Talib, he said, you know, I don't have good vibes about this. He said, people see things too clearly from caves on hills. And that was a bit prophetic, I guess. And anyway, he did this for months upon months, perhaps years. And one day he came down and came home to Khadija, and he was just absolutely, according to the tradition, visibly shaken. He couldn't speak. He was trembling. He was sweating. And he just sort of collapsed. And so when he came a bit to his senses, Khadija said, what in the world has happened to you? And he said, God spoke to me. Well, her reply was, what God? I mean, we have dozens of them. No, Allah, the God, spoke to me. And it's important, that word is important. Allah literally means the God. And, well, what did this God say? And he said, God told me to write down, you know, recite, he said. And he said, well, did you see God? No, I did not see God, but I saw an angel, and it was the angel Gabriel. Now, some people would say, you know, well, Muhammad copied from Judaism and Christianity. He didn't copy. He just assumed that they had originally at least a valid revelation from God, and so he respected them. And we're going to find out later, especially next week, that a lot of things he just assumed were true. And so obviously he couldn't make up that name and just hit it by chance, you know. Jibril was the Arabic name. And he says, Jibril spoke to me. Jibril was the messenger of God. So God is speaking the words he wants known to a Gabriel. Gabriel speaks to Muhammad. Muhammad hears the words. And what did the angel say? The angel said, recite in the name of your Lord who created man from a few drops of blood. Recite. And so that was in the year 610 when he was 40 years old. And these revelations will go on for another 22 years, okay? Muhammad was illiterate, so he could not write, and so he dictated the words to his very good friend who became his confidant, Abu Bakr. Abu Bakr would write down, so Muhammad would say, this is what the angel said, and these revelations went on, according to the tradition of Islam, for years upon years, and they finally became the Quran, or the Quran, if you wish, the English form version of that, K-O-R-A-N. The other one is Q-U apostrophe R-A-N, and if you hear a Muslim or a Muslim speak that name, it will sound like Quran, the Quran. The name Quran itself means recitation, which is the beginning of what Muhammad said Gabriel spoke to him, recite. So I need to tell you, because this is going to be of some importance here, not just slight importance, in this polytheistic Society of Mecca, they believed in female infanticide. They believed in it and they practiced it. Now, that wasn't peculiar just to that region of the world. You can come all the way around the world and go to the Eskimos of the Northwest, and they practice the same thing. You can find this in different parts of the world at different times. If the firstborn had to be a male. If it was a girl, depends where you lived. If you were an Aleut in the Northwest, you put the infant out on the ice floe until she froze to death. If you lived in Mecca, you took the infant out, dug a hole, buried her in the sand, and she smothered. That was the way it was. And you could go through three or four baby girls being born, and it was the same. It had to be a male. And Muhammad very early came, he says, I don't believe in this. I don't believe in this. And it's one of the first things that he's going to do in. So, a few things. So we've got Allah, the God, and the word Islam means submission to the will of God, to the will of Allah. If you can see this in writing, M-U-S-L-I-M or M-O-S-L-E-M, it's interchangeable. When you because you can't translate proper names and proper words. You can transliterate what they sound like. And if you speak to a person who follows Islam in one part of the world, you hear Muslim. If you speak to one of those in another part of the world, you hear Muslim. So it can be either spelled in English, M-U-S-L-A-M, or M-O-S-L-E-M. One who submits to the will of Allah. Okay? He will come to be called, he considered himself the seal of the prophets. And that's how he is revered in Islam. And I say that because they believe in all the prophets of the Jewish tradition, the Hebrew tradition more specifically called, and the Christian tradition. They believe in all the prophets because we Christians accept the prophets of the Old Testament or the Hebrew scriptures as well. And so he accepted those prophets. He singled out, we're going to come back to this next week, but just to name them now, you have six major ones. There was Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad. So Muhammad is the last. And called the seal because it's like these, God spoke through all these prophets, but in these last times, he has spoken finally to this man, Rasul, this messenger that I use, this go-between. And since there are no more revelations, I put my seal on all my revelations with the Prophet Muhammad, and that's how Muslims revere him. And he revered himself. They believe in, we'll touch on this a little bit too next week, but the Quran is, it's a literal dictation. So God spoke the words to Jibril, and Gabriel spoke them to the prophet, who spoke them to Abu Bakr, who wrote them down. And then their tradition believes it's literal, okay? It's not like, well, the human instrument was used, and with human language, these are the words, okay? And that's very important to them, extremely important to them. What happened after he had this first revelation? His first convert is going to be his wife, Khadija. She comes to believe in the one God. Okay, there is only really one God. That is the very basic foundation of Islam, as is of Christianity and Judaism as well. So then the rest of his household was converted. People started to see this and, you know, what's going on here, and it started to grow out of this nucleus, and little by little, more and more adherents are being added throughout the city of Mecca. And very early on, they come to the notice of the magistrates. You know, who is this man who comes speaking about one God? And if people take him seriously and get on board, there goes our business. There goes the whole thing down the tube, you know. There goes the gold and silver trade. There goes the sacrifice of hundreds of lambs every year in the spring fertility rites, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There goes Mecca as the center for the worship at the Kaaba. And so they start to hatch plans to see, first of all, they're going to try and deal with him. And so when they find out that he really is to be taken seriously, they call him in, and actually he wouldn't go. He sent his messenger, Abu Bakr, and they said, look, go and tell your man that we will give, how much gold does he want? How much silver does he want? Does he want his weight in gold? We will give him whatever he wants. We'll give him the keys to the city, you know. Just shut up. So Abu Bakr went back, and he returned with the answer. The prophet says, even if you were to put the sun in my one hand and the moon in my other, I would not cease and desist. Sorry. And so from there on, they started to hatch a plan. And they were convinced that he had to go. So first they started to persecute his followers. Torture was used first, and then outright torture to the point of death. And a common way was to, a common method rather, was to put you, lay you on the ground and put huge rocks on you until finally you couldn't breathe anymore and you just expired and that was it. But hopefully before it got to that point, you would recant and you would say, okay, I give up, you know, I'm not going to believe in this Allah anymore and I'm going to go back to the old ways and so on. That didn't happen, though. And with every religion that has come down the pike, the more you Christianity is a prime example itself. In Roman times, you know, in ancient Rome, the more you persecute, even to the point of death, the more people on the outside say, well, what is there about this that people are willing to die for it? And it has a reverse effect, and more adherents start to keep coming on board. And so, anyway, the magistrates finally hatched this plan, and they said, look, he's got to go. And his uncle told him, he said, look, if you don't leave the city, they're going to pick you off one by one by one until they get to you. And so Muhammad took that seriously, and he was mulling that over. And while he was doing that, the magistrates hatched this plan to kill him this one night. And so that the blood wouldn't be on any one person. This is almost like Murder on the Orient Express, you know. They said, we will choose by lot a son from every one of the tribes. And each of those sons, as representatives of the tribe, will rush up to his room on this given night, fling the door open and stab him. Everybody stabs him, and therefore nobody knows who dealt the death blow, so the blood is not on anyone's head. That was the plan. Well, Muhammad had a sixth sense about him, and the day before this happened, he quietly left the city, and he went to his cave. Well, they proceeded with the plan, burst open the door, rushed in, boom, flung back the covers, you know, and everybody's poised, and it's his cousin there whom they recognize. So where is he gone? Well, he's probably gone to his cave. So, and this is in the tradition of Islam. They call it the miracle of the cave. So according to that, they quickly sent a cohort, you know, of horsemen out to the cave, and the one in charge said, wait a minute, we're wasting our time. There's a spider web across the entrance of the cave, and there's a turtle dove nesting here. Neither of those would happen if people come and go. He must have gone the opposite direction. And so they pursued the opposite direction, of course, and that bought him the time. And then before that happened, though, I'm trying to say so many things at one time, before that event took place, he told his followers, yes, they're out to get me, and flee the city quietly and go up to the city of Medina and I will catch up with you, okay? And so they did. The rest of his followers left the city of Medina and, Mecca, and went north about 90 miles to Medina. It's north of Mecca there. See, Muhammad did catch up with them, and that event is so important in their history that they date their calendar from that event. It's called in Arabic the Hijra, usually anglicized into the Hijra, H-E-J-I-R-A, the Hijra. And they date their calendar from that, but you can't, and that's 622, by the way, in the year 622. But you can't just take 622 from 2017 and get the current year of Islam, because they follow a very strict, absolutely strict lunar calendar. And it doesn't change. The Jews follow a lunar calendar, but they modify it so that big feasts in Judaism pretty much still stay, you know, within the same month or so. But a prime example would be, this is why Ramadan moves every year up a few days, okay, and it keeps traveling around. To this year, 2017 is the year 1439 AH. After Hijra, and it gets that name from the Latin anno hegirae, and we anglicize it into just after Hijra, you know, AH. And they usually write it that way too, AH, 1439. Their calendar has always 29 days because it's a lunar calendar. Every month has 29 days. And every year has 348. So you lose 17 every year. What happens next? I'm going to try and get this up to, we've got quite a bit to cover here between 630 and 632. So Muhammad went to Medina, and there's an interesting tradition surrounding his arrival there. So he arrived on his camel, and they said, well, where's he going to live? And they said, well, let's just ask him to let the rains fall and let his camel go where it will, and wherever the camel stops, that's where we build his house. So that's according to what they did. And then, little by little, he converts the Medinans to Islam. And the whole city becomes the first Muslim city, not Mecca, it's Medina. And what will go on between 622 and about 628, he never forgot that they ran him out of town. I mean, and some of the things I didn't mention, I mean, they made it bad before they started to torture his followers. They just tried to make it bad for business for anybody who was a believer in this new religion. In Mecca, and not buy from him or her or them, as the case may be, and so it got pretty tough, and so he never really let go of that. And so what he did from Medina, north of Mecca, the camel caravan still came down on the trade routes, and they had to pass right past Medina, and so he would harass them in their comings and their going, and you know, month after month after month, he'd harass these caravans. And finally, the Meccans got fed up with that, and they just said, let's go get him. This is enough of this. Let's just wipe him out. And so he got wind of this plot also, and he was one of these people like a Napoleon. You're born with a tactical sense. You can't teach it. You're born with it inside. And he had this, and he said, before they get to the North Wells, we will be there first, and we will occupy the high ground, because he who occupies the high ground wins the day. Sure enough, they beat it out of town with his army, got to the North Wells first, and when the Meccans arrived, they were in for a shellacking, which they got. And so the Medinans, under his leadership, won that first round, and sent the Meccans packing back home. Well, they sat on that for a year or two, and they thought, let's try this again. And this time, they won the day. So you got 1-1. There was a third battle, and this time it was a draw. And so Muhammad sent an emissary to the Meccans, to the magistrates, to Bu Sufyan, and said, can't we work out terms of peace? And so they both sides agreed, okay, blah, blah, blah. And what they agreed to was, we will not attack you, you do not attack us. And furthermore, the Prophet got a bargaining chip through where he said, once a year, since this is our hometown, really, and we are exiles, you give us safe passage back to worship there at the Kaaba, but not as a place of idol worship. And we'll get into that a little bit later. For 3 days, we have safe passage in and out of the city. And that worked for about 4 years. And it was just fine. It was going along. One night, some hot-headed young Turks from Mecca thought, no, well, let's go show these guys what for. So they rode north, and there were sentry posts all around Medina, of course, for protection. They raided the north sentry post, doesn't matter, the south one, and killed everybody. So Muhammad was made known of, this is the event, And he said, but I've been a man of peace. And his uncle again said, they're going to still wipe you guys out, So he said, okay, reluctantly, I take up the sword and we will march on Mecca. So not knowing how this was going to go, he marched with his entourage, his military entourage, out of Medina south toward Mecca. And what had happened in the years since 622 now, 6 years later, is so many bands and clans around Medina had converted to Islam. And so as Muhammad's small army rode out, they were joined by this clan, by that clan, by this clan, by that clan. The further they went, the larger the army grew. And when Bu Sufyan, when the sentries at Mecca saw them coming, they referred the matter to Bu Sufyan, the chief magistrate, and he said, went up to the ramparts himself and took a look and saw this army coming, not a motley band, an army coming. He just said, open the gates and let them in. And so they did. And Muhammad gave strict orders. He said, this will not be what happens in usual taking of cities during wartime. There will be no pillaging. There will be no raping. There will be no breaking into houses. If the door is closed, you do not enter the home, etc., etc., etc. And he passed this down the rank and file, and his sergeants were to enforce this legislation, And so the whole thing was peaceful. And the whole, what he did was ride into the center of the city to the Kaaba and said, de-desecrate this place that Father Abraham has built. And it's Muslim belief and tradition that that shrine, which Muhammad himself believed, was built originally by Abraham and his son Ishmael. Abraham had Isaac and Ishmael, okay? And the Jews believe they're descended from Abraham through Isaac. Muslims believe they're descended from Abraham through Ishmael. And so our great father Abraham built this shrine and dedicated it way back when to the one true God. We reconsecrate and rededicate it to this one God. Get rid of those idols in there. And so they went into the Kaaba and throughout. Maybe we can take a look at this is about 150 years ago, maybe 125 years ago. But and what is there in the meantime is of course the these are the surrounding walls of the Great Mosque of Mecca. It's been enlarged probably 7-8 times over the centuries until it got to its size now. It's absolutely huge. So obviously the Kaaba has been refurbished over the centuries. I mean, because it's covered with fabric, you have to replenish that and refurbish it, okay? And which they have done. But this was the shrine that housed the chief gods and goddesses. So they threw those out, broke them into bits, and then he gave orders for them, which then, now this didn't exist, of course, then. This perimeter, there was an oval here, a huge oval, and to go around the oval and break all those idols to pieces also. And when that was done, then he said, now we can reconsecrate this to the one true God in the name of our father Abraham. Interesting that Christians, Muslims, and Jews refer to Abraham as Father Abraham. What in the next 2 years, so after he rededicated I got it back now. From that moment on, Mecca became their religious center, and it still is to this very day. The absolute holiest city for Muslims, is Mecca. The second is Medina. Anybody want to guess what the third one is? Jerusalem. Yes, Jerusalem. And we will come to that a little bit later, too, when we do the Dome of the Rock in the second part. Anyway, what Muhammad's plan was this. God sent prophets to the centuries ago, and that became the Jewish tradition. And that was a real revelation from God, a valid revelation from God. Then later on, God sent Jesus, a great prophet. And that grew, that revelation through Jesus Christ grew into the Christian tradition. And so he said, I accept these, and now I am the third and last revelation. But his plan was, because he thought this was God's plan, I will assume all of us, Christians, Muslims, Jews, into one big happy family, and that's the way it's going to be. That's what he thought should take place. And so he sent emissaries out to the religious capitals of the world, to Jerusalem, for example, to the Jews, to Constantinople, to the emperor, which was Byzantium then. And the message was, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. Accept Islam for your salvation. Well, the Jews' response was, are you greater than our father Abraham? Are you greater than Moses? Well, our prophet is the last of the prophets. He's the seal of the prophets. So get out of here. They wouldn't listen. So the emperor at Byzantium, you come to me out of the desert smelling like goats and camels and ask me to accept this from a man who should worship me on his knees. Out. And so he took the message that they gave to him, and he just tore it up. And so his plan starts to fray. And he probably died rather dispirited that it didn't work out that way. But he did not initiate the Muslim holy wars. A lot of people say, well, he was nothing but a warmonger. And my first response to that is, outside of taking Mecca, Muhammad didn't, in those battles at the wells and so on between the Meccans and the Medinans, he didn't fight anything. It was after he died, that the Muslim holy wars began. And the response was, if they would not listen to our prophet, then let us take Islam to the world for their salvation. We'll do it by conquering. I don't want to get into that too much. When Muhammad died, we can probably do this as a last section here. When Muhammad died, he realized, I'm the last of the prophets, I'm the seal, but there needs to be someone in charge, not as prophet, but as my deputy successor to keep things in order. And the name for that in Arabic is Caliph, anglicized into Caliph, C-A-L-I-P-H, Caliph. And so he said, I appoint Abu Bakr, who took the dictation, he is Caliph. So when Muhammad died, if the prophet names who the Caliph is going to be, you can't argue with that. He's Caliph. But only the next round, when they wanted to elect his successor, there were two factions that arose, came to the front, and one said, we think the next caliph should be from simply from the only prerequisite is he must be from the Quraysh, the clan of the Prophet Muhammad. That's the only prerequisite. And the more conservative viewpoint was, no, that's not good enough. Not only the clan, but of the immediate family of the Prophet. That only that person can become caliph. And they couldn't reconcile their differences, and they went ahead and named their own caliphs. And you had the birth then of the Sunnis and the Shiites. The Sunnis are the more moderate, okay, generally speaking, not only religiously, but politically. Sunni lands, for example, Saudi Arabia is almost completely Sunni. So is Jordan, predominantly Sunni. They get along, tend to be a little more moderate religiously, although the Sunnis in Saudi Arabia do have some strict rules. Okay, but overall, they tend to be more moderate and get along better with the Western powers, especially the United States, traditionally. The smaller group worldwide, the Sunnis are the dominant ones, okay? They're over 80% of the world population of Muslims. Maybe something like 12% or so are Shiites, but there are some territories that are predominantly Shiites, for example, Iraq. And Iran, Pakistan, predominantly Shiite. But in the worldwide population, they're a minority. And then you've got a group, they're the mystics of the Muslims, the Sufis, S-U-F-I, the Sufis. They are only about 5%. And you will find Sufis tend to predominate in Turkey, okay? A few things about Sunnis and that might be of interest to you. This has to do with the number, and this usually comes up as a question, you know, well, what about Muslims in the United States, Sunnis and Shiites and so on? There are approximately 2,000 mosques in the United States. 7% of those mosques are Shiite. And in the last 20 years, the Shiite Muslims are tending toward building their own mosques. Before that, they could kind of intermix a little bit, but they've garnered enough of a population here in the U.S. that they can build their own mosques and tend to go to those. And one of the reasons, too, is that more Shiite Muslims are fleeing persecution in Saudi Arabia. There is a very minority of Shiites there. In Iraq, Bahrain, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, as they have been persecuted there, okay? Let's see. I think that's all right now, okay? Let's go back to... maybe we can have the one with the minaret, the mosque with the minaret. Okay, when shortly after, and we can end on this section here, shortly after Muhammad went to Medina and took that city over, they built a place of worship, and the worship of Allah, and where they could read the Quran. They said, well, the Christians have a tradition of bells, and the Jews have the tradition at least once a year they call people to worship on Rosh Hashanah, which was yesterday, by the way, the beginning of Rosh Hashanah, with the shofar, the ram's horn. We have to have something different. And so they hit upon, after a little discussion here and there, let's just use the human voice. And one of the very first converts of... to Islam in the city of Mecca years before, who was about to be put to death he was in the household of Bu Sufyan, the chief magistrate, and Bu Sufyan found out this slave, this black slave of his, was an adherent of this new religion, Islam, and so he commanded that he should, through provocation from his wife, should be put to death. And at the last minute, literally, Muhammad sent a messenger, and he bought off the torturers and saved Bilal. And so they built this building, and then they said, well, we're going to use the human voice. And so they sent Bilal up onto the top. There were no minarets at the time. He just stood on the top of this new building and did the call to prayer. You know, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Come and pray, come and pray. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Come and pray. And they would cup their hands, Allahu Akbar. You recognize that as it's being used by people throughout the world, terrorists and so on. They cry, you know, these, which is, it's a bastardization of the sacredness of that word. You know, I do this in the name of God. It's not in the name of God, for heaven's sakes. But anyway, Allahu Akbar, God is great. La ilaha illallah, Muhammad Rasulallah. Well, then after time, they started to build these tall towers. And the greater the mosque, the greater the minarets. You only have to have one. So if it's an ordinary mosque, you have one minaret. If it's a little more affluent, you have two. If it's really a wealthy mosque, you've got, or the adherents are wealthy, you know, you have four at each corner. And the criers, so these obviously go way back centuries ago, way, way, way before we ever had electronics. And so they would go up onto these tall areas here, way up here, and sometimes on the top one, and so that you could be heard. You could be heard. When we get to next week and talking more about this, I want to share some stories about having been in Cairo for 3 or 4 days years ago and experiencing these calls to prayer. You hear them all over the city because there's so many mosques and they all have the call to prayer at the same time. Five calls of prayer a day and they all pick the same time. And so you hear these, you know, and it's very impressive. Now they use loudspeakers in connection with the height, and so you really can hear them for all over the city. Okay, it reverberates; it really does. And the crier is called a muezzin, M-U-E-Z-Z-I-N, muezzin. And I've had a number of students over the years, especially at Mercy High School, who were Muslims. Some, mostly Sunnis, some Shiites. And I remember one time I said, "Well, the muezzin." And this young lady started to giggle in the back, and I said, well, what's so funny? And she said, well, we call him the muezzin. That's how you pronounce it in my tradition, the muezzin. You got to do a T. Okay, it's the muezzin. I think that is where I want to leave it right now. And take a break and come back, because I do want to leave time at the end for, I don't want to do a whole hour in the second half, but leave it time at the end for Q&A, okay, which I'm sure, I hope will occur, all right? So let's take about 10 minutes right now and have some refreshments, and we'll come back and do the second part.